The Ark of Millions of Years, Chapter 13, The Arrival of Noah. This is a continuation of the chapter, The Garden of Eden. The waters of the flood are upon the spiritual creation, and the Ark of Noah is borne up and lifted from the earth. However, at this point, the Ark was not yet underway, because it was tethered to the landscape until the ship had enough draft clearance to safely pass over the submerged landscape. In the Mesopotamian accounts, Noah, Unapishtipin, has appointed the sailor, Buzu Kurgala, to be in charge of the great ship. We read in the account that the cables of the ship were cast loose, and another sailor, named Urugal, parted the anchor cable. In Genesis chapter 7, it reads, "And the waters prevailed, and were increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark went upon the face of the waters." It was not until the cables were loosed that the ark went, or moved, upon the face of the waters. We read further in Genesis, 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. The 15 cubits upward is speaking about the draft of the vessel. The ship, laden with tonnage of supplies and all aboard, drew 15 cubits of water, which enabled the vessel to pass safely above all the obstructions of the landscape without scraping the bottom or running aground. David Fassold, in his book The Ark of Noah, states that drogue stones were used to restrain the ark from being cast sideways and broaching in a following sea if it didn't maintain a position keeping the sharp upswept stern into the waves. He further states that it was not the weight of the stones that accomplished this, but the surface area of the stone. That is why they are long and flat and need not be thicker than what is needed for strength, not weight. The stones varied slightly in size, but averaged 10 feet in length and 5 feet in width, with the thickest portion near the top by the hole where the lines were attached. Several of these stones may have trailed on longer lines far astern of the others in a forceful sea. There were at least 15 tons of drogue stones trailing astern. They were never hoisted aboard, but in all likelihood had spares aboard to replenish a percentage of those lost. The Sin Leki Unini version of the Epic of Gilgamesh mentions a nautical three-standard tow rope in Tablet 5, Column 11, and in Tablet 10, Column 11. There is found mention of drogue stones. Ur-Shanabi is the boatman who will take Gilgamesh across the waters of death to the dwelling place of Utnapishtim, or Noah. In the account, there has been some sort of incident, and Ur-Shanabi reprimands Gilgamesh for the damage he's done. In line 37, he says, "Your own hands, Gilgamesh, have hindered the crossing." In line 40, it says, "The stone things are broken." Perhaps in this incident, the drogue stones were stuck, breaking the holes out and freeing their attaching lines. An argument ensued, but apparently feelings were patched up, as well as the equipment. Line 41, it says, "And the stone things he loaded in the boat." Line 42, "The stone things without which there is no crossing death's waters." These drogue stones were most important to the ship's safety in crossing. It can be compared as being afraid to drive a car without brakes, as the drogue stones had brake-like action. An anchor or a dragging stone was necessary to keep the boat from broaching and throwing those on deck into the waters of death. Herodotus relates the use of drogue stones by vessels sailing the Nile in Egypt to prevent currents pushing vessels ashore on the bank when rounding bends, and a low-lying raft was equipped with a sail under the raft, which caught the river currents full force. This was made fast to the ship's bow by a tow rope. Men on the raft then shot off downriver with the vessel trailing behind. The raft was equipped with sweep oars and darted around the curve in the river with the boat's bow in irons. The vessel's stern tended to turn around but was made to track through the use of a breaking stone that weighed about 120 pounds. The weight of the stone applied just enough tension on the stern to make the tow follow correctly. The book of Enoch the prophet records, "In those days Noah saw that the earth became inclined, sinking, and that destruction approached. And he said, Tell me what is transacting upon earth, for the earth labors and is violently shaken. Surely I shall perish with it." In Sanskrit text of the Mahabharata, Vanaparva states, "The earth, as if oppressed with an excessive burden, sank down, suffering pains in her limbs, and the earth in distress was deprived of her senses by excessive pressure." The Babylonians described the earth's sinking as the god of the underworld tore out the posts of the dam. Rabbinical sources add that the earth was quaking amidst lightnings and thunderings. Then a very loud, terrible sound was heard in all the earth, never heard before. The sun became darkened, and the foundation of the cosmos was dislodged. The Babylonian accounts continue as follows. "All the earth spirits leaped up with flaming torches, and with brightness thereof they lit up the earth." Another rabbinical source reveals that during the 7 days, the earth was flooded by sheets of light, and terrifying signs and commotion filled the heavens. The father of Methuselah, while lying down in the house of his grandfather, Malaleel, saw in a vision the earth sinking into a great abyss to its destruction. The above accounts are descriptions of the spiritual earth being torn or removed from its foundation and orbit, and the beginning of its descent into the blackness of space, described in the above account as the Great Abyss. The sheets of light described above are the electrical discharges from the spiritual earth into the heavens as it begins its descent. The sky is blackened and described above as the sun becoming darkened, but what really has happened is the spiritual earth, with its protective atmosphere, has left its orbit from the spiritual sun and is falling down into the blackness of space. The falling or sinking action into space exerts a feeling of tremendous pressure felt by all aboard the ark. The electrical storms are raging, with tremendous waves from the fountains of the great deep being broken up, and from the windows of heaven that were opened. Chapter 6 of the Book of Jasher describes the intensity of the raging storms on the surface of the spiritual globe as follows. "And the ark was tossed upon the waters, so that all the living creatures within were turned about like pottage in a cauldron. And great anxiety seized all the living creatures that were in the ark, and the ark was like to be broken. And all the living creatures that were in the ark were terrified, and the lions roared, and the oxen lowed, and the wolves howled, and every living creature in the ark spoke and lamented in its own language, so that their voices reached to a great distance. And Noah and his sons cried and wept in their troubles. They were greatly afraid that they had reached the gates of death." Lamentations chapter 1 records this event. "And cast down from heaven unto the earth the beauty of Israel." The beauty of Israel is the spiritual earth. "And remembered not his footstool in the day of his anger." The Zohar, or the Book of Splendor, states, "He hath cast down the earth from the heavens." As the spiritual globe was descending through the spiritual universe where it was created, the rain and storms continued for 40 days and 40 nights. The 40 days and 40 nights described only the length of time the rains continued. It is implying that for the equivalent of 40 days and nights, the rain continued for 24 hours without stopping, because the earth was now only experiencing darkness. Rabbinical sources state that that during the deluge, the sun and the moon shed no light. Other same source rabbinical writings say Noah and his crew were given light that illuminated all of the ark and served as a timepiece to distinguish night from day during the fall. The source of the light came from the Divine Book of Wisdom, which was made of sapphires and housed in a golden casket. The spiritual, or airy, earth was rapidly descending through the various levels of the spiritual universes, traveling in the fourth dimension. At each level of entry into the different spiritual universes, heavens, or dimensions, the enormous, mighty celestial gates of heaven were opened by the watchers, who are surrounded by a flaming fire, and by the command of God, they let the spiritual, or airy, earth pass through its portals and continue its descent. Charles L. Walker, a contemporary of Brigham Young, a Mormon prophet, heard the sermon containing the following statement. He reported this in his diary, July 13, 1862. In the evening, Brother Brigham spoke, and that when this world was first made, it was in close proximity to God. When man sinned, it was hurled millions of miles away from its first position, and that was why it is called the fall. As the spiritual, or airy, earth was falling rapidly through the spiritual universes or dimensions, it was also passing through time zones. It was literally passing through millions of years in a matter of days. It may have had the appearance of a shooting star in its fall through the fourth dimension, or maybe some sort of hyperdimensional space travel discussed in the chapter The Dimensions was the mode of transport. By whatever means of space travel was employed, the spiritual globe was traveling rapidly through time, space, and dimensions. In the meantime, the temporal Earth, our planet, in the temporal or physical universe, was experiencing a terrible cataclysm that nearly destroyed the planet. Our solar system had a visitor that passed within the orbit of Jupiter and close to the orbit of Earth. Its gravity, combined with the speed and trajectory, caused havoc to Earth and other planets. The preceding chapter, The Cataclysm, tells of this event, and it is even chronicled in Job chapter 38. Canst thou bring forth Maseroth in his season, or canst thou guide Arcturus with his sons? The cosmic visitor approaches closer, and the events on Earth become increasingly larger. The tidal waves become enormous tsunamis of gigantic proportions. The gravity of the approaching interloper pulls the waters of the oceans out of their beds, attaining miles in height. When they are released from the pull of gravity, they fall back as great crashing waves of immense power and destruction, producing similar effects of a great flood, such as this planet has never before known in historical times. The temporal planet was experiencing a flood and destruction nearly the same time as the spiritual globe. Psalms chapter 33 describes this event. He gathereth the waters of the sea together as an heap. He layeth up the depth in storehouses. And then in chapter 93 of Psalms, the floods have lifted up, O Lord, the floods have lifted up their voice, the floods lift up their waves. And then in chapter 60, thou hast made the earth to tremble, thou hast broken it, heal the breaches thereof, for it shaketh. The gravitational pull from the near collision of the cosmic interloper caused terrible earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, raging tempests, and fracturing of the planet's crust that resulted in the earth being slowed by the dragging of the crust as it was pulled off. The earth slowed its rotational speed, and the distance of the moon from the earth was changed, some say closer and others say further away. Earth lost approximately 10% of its circumference and more than half of its crust. This caused the tilting of the planet's axis to a new angle and created the wobble in its new axis. The oscillations in a back-and-forth surging motion caused continents to move to new locations. Mountains rose in minutes. Psalms chapter 114 states, "The mountains skipped like rams, and the little hills like lambs." The continents in their move left marks or tracks in their wakes that solidified. You can see the tracks that India left as it raced toward the Asian continent. South America can be moved back into Africa and Australia into Antarctica by tracing the tracks that are carved in the basins. Most of the continents had changes in terrain as they smashed into each other, resulting in folding and bunching up. Millions of years of uniformitarianism, continental drift, were accomplished in days. The planet was left wounded, with a gaping hole on one side and the remaining crust on the opposite side. For up to 25 years or more, the planet suffered a collapsed sky, darkness, and unbearable cold. 90% of life was wiped out. It was when the planet nearly died, 11,500 years ago, or 9,500 BC. Immanuel Velikovsky's book, Worlds in Collision, recognized the compelling evidence of a catastrophic world event caused by a runaway planet that nearly collided with Earth. A planet that he identified and thought was Venus, now in a stable orbit. He recognized the cataclysm, but wrongly identified the cosmic interloper. There is an ancient Babylonian cylinder seal in the East Berlin State Museum that apparently shows the planets in more or less their correct order, in an anti-clockwise direction, or in the direction that they naturally orbit the sun. One planet, identified as Tiamat, is missing. What happened to this planet? There is an ancient Akkadian creation epic that describes a war in heaven between the gods, planets being named for gods, and tells of a planet, Marduk, or Marduk, alias Phaeton, entering into the solar system from the heart of the deep cosmic space where it was created. The epic states, "In the chamber of fates, the place of destinies, a god was engendered, most able and wisest of gods. In the heart of the deep was Marduk created." The saga described Marduk as a radiant and huge visitor from a distant interstellar region, spewing great jets of fire. Alluring was his figure, sparkling the lift of his eyes. Lordly was his gait, commanding as of olden times. Greatly exalted was he above the gods, exceeding throughout. When he moved his lips, fire blazed forth. After entering the solar system, Marduk first encountered Neptune, or Ea, and then Uranus, or Anu, passing Saturn, or Anshar, but became trapped for a time by the three large outer planets' gravitational fields. This began to affect the orbit of Tiamat and its satellite Kingu, which appeared to Earth's peoples and as an onslaught of gods preparing for war. Marduk plunged on and began to approach Tiamat and the inner planets. The epic then tells how Tiamat, under attack from deranged Marduk, begins to break up in a celestial battle as follows. Tiamat and Marduk, the wisest of the gods, advanced against one another. They pressed on to single combat. They approached for battle. Marduk then spread out his net to enfold her. The evil wind, the rearmost, he unleashed at her face. As she opened her mouth, Tiamat, to devour him, he drove the evil wind so that she closed not her lips. The fierce storm winds then charged her belly. Her body became distended. Her mouth had opened wide. He shot there through an arrow. It tore her belly. It cut through her insides, tore into her womb. Having thus subdued her, her life breath, he extinguished. Marduk, having demolished Tiamat, drags the remains of Tiamat with it, forming a tail of debris which streams out behind as a great band or bracelet. Today, these probably represent the asteroid belt. Jewish scripture refers to Marduk simply as the Lord. The heavens bespeak the glory of the Lord. The hammered bracelet proclaims his handiwork. And very significantly adds, from the end of heaven he emanates. As already noted from the Babylonian epic, Marduk came from the great deep or end of heaven. Marduk then continued wandering erratically among the planets in a sunwards direction, narrowly missing Earth, but causing conflagration, tectonic upheavals, crust removal, and a tremendous flood upon this planet. It is believed that Marduk or Phaeton plunged into the sun. But what if it didn't? Will this cosmic visitor one day return to again wreak havoc in our solar system? More evidence is found in the Indo-Iranian Zend Avesta, as these planets ran against the sky and created confusion, and the celestial sphere was in revolution. The planets, with many demons, dashed against the celestial sphere and mixed the constellations. These demons were presumably the debris of Tiamat. Homer's Iliad contains a lengthy account of a celestial battle. The story is pretty much the same, but with Greek names of gods and goddesses attached to the planets. Paraphrasing Homer's account, we find that Pallas Athene, Venus, removes Ares, Mars, from the battlefield. Mars's orbit is altered, only for the two to meet again, this time furious Ares abiding on the left of the battle. Marduk passes around behind Mars and crosses inside Mars's orbit. Aphrodite, the moon, tries to enter the conflict. The moon, affected gravitationally, Ares then darkens the battlefield. The Martian atmosphere becomes disturbed, and Pallas Athene is seen to retreat. Marduk moves away from Mars. Hera, the goddess of Earth, then complains at this celestial conflict. Earth is affected electromagnetically. Numerous lightning bolts described as spears are exchanged between Pallas Athene and Ares. Pallas Athene retaliates by heaving a gigantic black jagged and great stone. This is the remaining portion of the dead Tiamat at Ares, and thereby loosed his limbs, caused Mars to oscillate. Aphrodite, the moon, came to Ares' assistance, whose hand she took and sought to lead away. The moon's gravitational pull caused Mars to move further away from Marduk, but Pallas Athene sped in pursuit and smite Aphrodite on the breast, and her heart melted. In other words, Marduk discharged an electromagnetic bolt at the moon. Earthbound observers perceived Venus attacking Mars, but it was something bright and star-like, Marduk, that became embroiled in heavenly strife with Mars. Old Persian texts expressly state that Tistria, the leader of the stars against the planets, proceeded along his winding course. Phaeton pursued a meandering sunward course through the solar system from planet to planet, much like playing pinball. These ancient writings, sagas, and epics recorded the cataclysm that nearly destroyed the earth and the conflict in the heavens, long thought to be myths, but written to the ancient people's understanding and interpretation of the events that took place. In the meanwhile, the spirit, or airy earth, has passed through the last portal of heaven into the temporal universe and descends to its soul mate and carbon copy, the temporal planet. It has taken a year of celestial time to fall through the heavens. It immediately attaches itself and enters the temporal planet. The two planets have united and become as one. The Zohar affirms this unity in the following writing. This is the supernal world to which this earth is attached and from which it is nourished. The word nourished, used in context here, would mean replenished. The waters of the flood are now upon the temporal planet, but not one drop of water has wet this planet because it was spiritual water. This event occurred sometime later, after the cataclysm, because of time travel through the fourth dimension. When the spirit earth reached its destination, several thousand years had passed since the temporal planet had experienced a near-death blow. The Zohar comments on the cataclysm and spiritual earth being removed from heaven as follows. And when the Holy One resolved to destroy his house and the holy land below, he first removed the holy land, which is above, the celestial prototype, and cast it down from that grade where it had formerly imbibed nourishment from the holy heaven. And then he caused the land below to be devastated. First, he cast down from heaven the earth, and then he remembered not his footstool. It wasn't until the two planets united that this planet was called Earth. The words of the song, Colors of the Wind, from the movie Pocahontas, so movingly expressed the red man's knowledge of this event. You think you own whatever land you land on. The earth is just a dead thing, you claim. But I know every rock and tree and creature has life, has a spirit, has a name. The temporal planet now has a spirit and a name, Earth. The earth, with all its animals, the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the air, have become living souls. Latter-day Revelation reveals that the earth, the animals, the fishes of the sea, the fowls of the air, as well as man, are to be recreated or renewed through the resurrection, for they too are living souls. The Zohar supports this belief by the following writing. Let the earth bring forth a living soul according to its kind, namely cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth after its kind. Back to Noah. The first drog, or signal stone, that touched bottom gave warning that the ark was coming into shallow water. Noah knew that he had to act quickly to determine if the shallow water was a suitable landing site, because receding waters caused strong, raging currents that could drag the ark over dangerous landscapes to its destruction. Acting quickly, while the tidal bulges were still in effect, he unlashed and lowered the steering oar to below the bottom of the hull. Drogue stones were positioned on either side of the ark to help guide and hold position, and one drogue was positioned aft to act as a breaking stone, should the current prove too strong. The ark continued its forward movement, gliding gently eastward upon the receding tides toward the slopes of Mount Masher. When Noah called to have the shaft of the sweep oar rotated, slowly causing the ark to veer in a semicircle toward the south, where the high place of Kudi al-Judi acted as a point to check against sideways drift. The breaking drogstone touched bottom, surging the line taut, slowing the great ship, and now and then catching on obstructions below, further slowing its forward movement. The starboard drogstones were slackened to decrease the angular tack, and the great ark came back down to earth, settling on the soft slopes of al-Judi, buckling the large steering oar under the weight of the hull. The Bible says, "And the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat." But in the original King James Version, Ararat was rendered as Armenia. The Quran, in Hud, chapter 11, states, "And the ark rested on the Judi." According to Muslim tradition, the ark is on a hill, not a mountain, but upon the mountainous range of Urartu, Ararat, or ancient Armenia, and from the Quran, al-Judi. The following writings of Berosus seem to make it most clear that the landing site was in Armenia. A portion of the ship which came to rest in Armenia still remains in the mountains of the Khor Duelans of Armenia, and some of the people, scraping off pieces of bitumen from the ship, bring them back and use them as talismans. Mount Ararat has a deep chasm or rift known as the Ahura Gorge, caused by an earthquake in 1840. In the mountain of Ararat and the Ahura Gorge, there is a piece of ice in the shape of an upside-down heart. This area is the peak of the mountain known as al-Judi. The Muslim Quran states that the ark came to rest on al-Judi, and the people for many years thought that al-Judi was a completely different mountain. Recently, it was learned that al-Judi refers to this particular peak in the mountain of Ararat. Therefore, it appears that the Bible and Quran refer to the same mountain. This was probably Armenia in ancient times. Genesis chapter 8 states, "And it came to pass, in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from off of the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. And God spake unto Noah, saying, Go forth of the ark, thou and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee, every beast, every creeping thing, and every fowl, and whatever creepeth upon the earth after their kinds, went forth out of the ark. The Lord, having dried off the spiritual waters from the face of the temporal earth, now commanded Noah and all those souls and animals aboard the ark to disembark. Once all those souls on board, including the animals and fowls, touched the dry land, they became fully mortal, and the ark became temporal. The invisible became visible. In the twinkling of an eye, their celestial nature was changed to that of the earthly, without even being aware that such a change had happened. The Zohar states that spiritual beings in descending on earth must put on themselves earthly garments, flesh and blood, as otherwise they could not stay in this world, nor could the world endure them. It happened on the very birthday of the patriarch, or the 601st year, first month, first day of the month of the life of Noah, bearing in mind that this was still a celestial year and not measured, the same as on their new place of habitation. The Zohar implies that the length of a celestial year could be much longer time than currently thought by the following statement. And God remembered Noah, for Noah, having been so long out of sight, had to be specially brought to mind. Noah knew that he was in a different place because the light of the sun and the moon was noticeably not as bright. The order of nature was reversed, the sun now rising in the east and setting in the west, instead of rising in the west and setting in the east. The sky was different. After another change was that this planet had seasons, or a time in which to plant and harvest crops, and climates of hot and cold areas, due to its new axis tilt. The spiritual earth, apparently, was also temperate with a vertical axis. The Lord revealed these changes to Noah in Genesis chapter 8. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. Most noticeably was the dietary change. The Lord told Noah that every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you. Prior to the deluge, all were vegetarians, including the animals. Apparently, temporal bodies of both men and animals require meat for health. Some of the animals that were on the ark became carnivorous. All the animals and fowls, once tame, now feared and dreaded Noah and his family. Genesis chapter 9 states, "And God blessed Noah and his sons, and said unto them, Be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered." Another new phenomenon was rain. There was no rain on the spiritual earth until the flood, when the windows of heaven were open. Now the Lord gives a rainbow as a token of a covenant between him, Noah, and life on the temporal earth, as stated in Genesis chapter 9. "And it shall come to pass, when I bring a cloud over the earth, but the bow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you, and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh." Rain has been on the temporal earth almost since its beginning, but unknown on the spiritual earth. Everyone here knows that rainbows are formed opposite the sun by refraction and reflection of the sun's rays in rain, spray, and mist, producing a bow or arc that exhibit the colors of the spectrum. It must have been a beautiful and impressive event as seen by Noah and his people for the first time. Another change, although not immediately noticed, was mortality. The lifespan of man was gradually shortened until the days of Moses, and then fixed at about 120 years. The ancients did attain a long duration of life because they were beloved by God because of their virtue and the good use they made of it in astronomical and geometrical discoveries, which would not have afforded the time of foretelling the periods of stars unless they had lived 600 years, for the great years completed in that interval. Josephus further states in his writings that the ancients lived 1,000 years, which is verified by many historians such as Manetho, Berosus, Mochus, Hestius, Herionymus, Hesiod, Hecatius, Hellenicus, Acusilius, Ephorus, and Nicholas. In other words, the ancients were permitted a longer duration of life in order to preserve knowledge. Noah lived 950 years and died a mortal's death without being translated, as previously most had been taken or translated at death on the spiritual earth. Again, it must be emphasized that a year of temporal earth time was not the same as on the spiritual earth that used celestial time. It took the ancients a long time to rethink on this sphere as to hours, days, months, and as to what constituted a year, and at the time, studying the movements of astral bodies in the solar system. Until time was recalculated, celestial time was continued. Noah, having lived much longer than 950 years, may have lived much longer than 950 years if celestial time is greater than temporal earth time. The temporal earth, having passed through a great cataclysm several thousand years previously, had need of replenishing that which was lost. The animals from the ark paired off and eventually joined other animal populations that survived the cataclysm. There may not have been giraffes, monkeys, skunks, etc. On board the ark, as these animals could have survived the cataclysm in sufficient numbers to replenish themselves. Only the animals, fowls, and creeping things from the spiritual creation were aboard the ark. There were no noxious insects on the ark. Insects were only on the temporal earth. The spiritual earth was free of flies, wasps, hornets, ants, beetles, mosquitoes, etc. We guess that is why it was considered a paradise. Creeping animals referred to small, slow animals such as sloths and opossums. Turtles could have survived the cataclysm by simply digging in. We don't know for sure what kinds of animals came from that creation, but they were brought here to replenish and to add to the diversity of Earth's existing animal and fowl life, forms that had survived the great cataclysm. This is why the ark didn't have to be the size of the state of California. My daughter Eve may have supposed this. It is the answer to the question that my daughter asked me about 15 years ago. Refer back to the forward section of this book for the question. Many new, modern, smaller-sized life forms of animals made their appearance on the scene suddenly, all arriving on the ark. Ancient species, such as the woolly mammoth, giant saber-toothed tiger, giant sloths, huge armadillos, giant anteaters, and other species of great size, were extinguished in the cataclysm. Maybe the newer, more modern, smaller-sized animal species, such as the Indian elephant, tigers, armadillos, anteaters, were on the ark as their replacement. One creature that probably arrived on the ark was the plain domestic house cat. From earliest recorded times, the domestic house cat has preferred to make its home with man, and always domestic. They are only wild if forced to fend for themselves without human contact, and even then, they are very easily tamed. Another animal that has a different genetic background is the dog. Wolves were common in large and small species on the temporal earth. The modern species of dog did not descend from the wolf, although there have been instances where wolves were successfully bred with dogs. The genetic code from dogs could not have been derived from wolves. The modern dog was more likely introduced to the current race of man from the ark. We do know from the Bible scriptures that cattle, doves, and ravens were on board, and that both clean and unclean animals were taken on board. Noah built an altar unto the Lord, and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl, and offered them as burnt offerings on the altar. The clean beasts were probably sheep, cattle, and goats, and the clean fowl were probably doves. Noah afterwards became a husbandman or breeder of domestic animals, most probably cattle, sheep, and goats, maybe some horses and a few camels, perhaps chickens, ducks, and geese. He planted vineyards and perhaps introduced new varieties of grains. This chapter will be continued in the chapter titled The Brave New World. The flood was indeed a global flood. It happened on the spiritual earth, which united with the temporal earth and became accounted for as one planet, now called Earth. Therefore, in a sense, the flood occurred on both the spiritual and temporal earths. It is the same for us as if we had a spiritual soul and a temporal body that have united but are accounted for as one being or personage. Because both planets are now one, the history that applied to the spiritual creation applies to the temporal earth as well. In this enlightened view, the flood indeed occurred on earth, and it was global. This union is called the union of the polarity, and will be discussed in the following chapter. The Zohar explains the verse, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth," means that the lower world was created after the pattern of the upper. What the Zohar is trying to say in the above scripture is, in the beginning God created the heaven, upper or spirit earth, and the earth, lower or temporal earth. When one views the above verse enlightened by ancient Jewish interpretation, the meaning becomes much more profound and clear about the creation. Genesis now becomes understandable when it implies that there were two creations. The word heaven meant the upper or spirit earth to the ancients. Terminology and meaning of words can change with the ages, even to the meaning of the simple word heaven. We have retained the ancient meaning of heaven as used in Genesis. It may not have been necessary to write this book, as the religious theologians would probably have figured it all out by now. Down through the ages, the 9500 BC cataclysm of the temporal earth and the flood of Noah story have become confused and intertwined. The two events were separate and occurred several thousand years apart, yet close enough in time to be thought of by the descendants of the ancients as the same event. It is this confusion of the two events that have given rise to so many myths and flood stories that are similar to one another, yet contain some truths. Noah, when he arrived, saw the destruction on the recovering earth from the cataclysm and wrongly assumed it was from the deluge, was the source of the two events becoming entangled. The Mesopotamians regarded Noah and his family as gods because they came through the judgment and because of the longevity that they carried with them into the new world. The story of how Noah and his family survived the deluge by traveling from the heavens to earth by sailing across the cosmic sea in the divine boat of Noah, or the boat of a million years, became legendary, adding to their status as gods and heroes. The cosmic sea is the dark rift in the Milky Way that contains a black hole. Egyptian legends suggest that Noah's divine ship sailed through the black hole into this universe. Of course, this would be the spirit earth traveling through a black hole, trans-dimensional portal. The Egyptians were notorious borrowers and modifiers of legends and religion to serve the political scenario of the times. The Egyptian Book of the Dead, written by the scribe Ani, refers to the flood story. Referring to this account, E.A. Wallace Budge, later keeper of Egyptian antiquities at the British Museum, informs us in his work, The Egyptian Book of the Dead, as follows. A general destruction of mankind was caused by the flood which was brought upon the world by the god Temu, who announced his intention of destroying everything in it and of covering the earth with the waters of the primeval ocean, Nu. All life was destroyed, and the only beings who survived were those who were in the boat of the millions of years. For example, the Ark of the Sun God with the god Temu. The Egyptians replaced Noah and his family with their god, Ra, and his companions, whose sun bark sailed over the heavens daily, but originally it was known as the Uanu, the divine boat of Nu, or Noah. Shem was known to the Egyptians as one of the eight survivors of the flood and one of the god-like antediluvians from the divine boat of Nu. When the gods use the great ship to travel between the worlds, it is called the boat of a million years. Again, the papyrus of Ani, line 20, it states that The boat of Nu is said to be the color of green for the divine chiefs. The authors wish to restore Noah and his family back to their rightful place and claim to fame as survivors on the boat, the divine boat of Noah. And since it traveled between the great universes through the fourth dimension of time and space, deem it appropriate to call his divine ship the Ark of Millions of Years. By the word of God, the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. Could it be that the above scripture, 2 Peter chapter 3, of the earth standing out in the water, apparently at the same time refers to when the flooded spiritual earth merged with the temporal earth, and the waters of the flood were on both planets, but not a drop of water wet the temporal earth because it was spiritual water. The earth, in a sense, was standing in and out of the water at the same time. Does not the scripture refer to a new heaven and a new earth, which are now the old heavens or world then, the spirit earth having left its former abode, having perished? It took from the time of Adam's transgression to the flood of Noah and the destruction of the spiritual earth for the fall to be complete.